You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Kevin Barry seemed to burst on the literary scene fully formed with his critically acclaimed debut novel, City of Bohane, which won the international, is it called Impact?
It's the Impact, yeah.
Impact Dublin Literary Award. He has followed up with a new short story collection called Dark Lies the Island, tales of bruisers, drinkers, and punks set in the ominous hills of his native Ireland. It's published by Grey Wolf, and I'm very pleased that it brings Kevin Barry to our show today to talk about it. Welcome.
Great to be here, Leonard. Thank you.
The title Dark Lies the Island is a reference to Ireland, I assume, where most of these stories are set. How much a part of Irish identity these days are the green hills and cliffs by the sea, or that old song, Just a Little Bit of Heaven That Fell from Out the Sky One Day?
Well, the green hills are still there, but also is the fact that Ireland is now probably a 90% suburban country. And for some odd reason, this has never really surfaced in our literature, because maybe it doesn't fit with the mythic sense of what Irish writing is supposed to be. So it's very interesting for me as a writer to look into that new ex-urban and suburban Irish existence and see what that's given us now.
But you also have dialogue here that is not of the sort that I recognize from most Irish writers. You are writing from many of these stories in northwestern Ireland. Mm-hmm. And you say that the way that people speak there has not really been addressed very much over the years.
Sure. I mean, Irish talk is a wonderful resource for a writer. We love the sound of our own voices and we're good at it. But the really interesting thing about Irish conversation and talk is we say very little. Under the lovely babble of conversation, there's not much actually being said, and it's what's under the surface is often very, very interesting.
Well, your dialogue is full of regionalisms and slang. You were born in Limerick. You live in County Sligo now. Is that the way people talk there?
Yeah, I mean, and sometimes people ask, is it going to be a difficulty, for example, for American readers? But I proceed on the theory that if I can get Baltimore, for example, Baltimore can get me, you know?
Can understand what's being said on the wire.
Exactly so. And you have to do a little work maybe early on, and you have to learn the patois. But once you're in, and you have it.
Well, how much of it comes out of the bilingual aspect of the Irish language?
For sure. I mean, the English language as it's spoken in Ireland has this strange, wonderful, very beautiful undertow underneath, which is the Gaelic language, the Irish language, and the way we form our sentences and the way we open out the language in all its aspects, very much of it comes from that lost language.
What about correct English? Is it different in Ireland than it is in England or the United States?
We're looser, Leonard. We're jazz. We just go with it, you know? And Irish talk is very rhythmic. It's very melodic. It's quite mellifluous. But again, I when I listen to Irish talk, I always remember something that Norman Mailer said once about when men talk. He said, whenever two men say hello to each other on the street, one of them loses. And he could have been talking very specifically, I think, about Irish men. There's always these secret little power battles and taunts going on.
In one of these stories, somebody who's injured is his friends josh him rather than offer sympathy.
Yeah, our default mode in Ireland is comedy. And humour, and we make jokes and laugh at the backs of funerals and outside the funeral house the night before, because we cannot deal with the black realities, and we use this neurotic humorous impulse to get through.
Well, most Irish writers cite Joyce as a major influence, but here you are quoting Norman Mailer, and you in interviews you mentioned Saul Bellow a lot.
For sure. Yeah.
So the sort of thing that you do, writing serious literature, become some kind of an international thing?
I think it has. I think it's opened out hugely. And when I was in my 20s, the great American Jewish writers were where I went all the time. Roth, Saul Bellow, and so forth. Yeah, for sure. And I was just feeding on that stuff. And, of course, it led me into delusion that I was the next great Jewish-American writer, which didn't work out. So I had to go back closer to home, ultimately.
Well, in one of the stories, a character bemoans that a teenage boy with a mid-Atlantic twang doesn't even seem Irish anymore.
You can hear kids now talking in Malahide in County Dublin, and it sounds like they come from Malibu. You know, it's kind of smoothed out into this kind of mid-Atlantic kind of twang. It's from TV, it's from watching DVDs, it's from watching movies, it's from being online all day. In that way that the world has kind of flattened because of technology and its reach.
And do people fear that everything will become Americanized?
I guess so, and I think it can open out into a certain blandness when national identities get chipped away to the extent that happens. But that's the strange new world we're living in and operating in, and writers have to be so alert to the changes in the way language is used.
I read somewhere that you've said the best long-form fiction is on American TV.
I firmly believe that there's nothing been done in the novel that rivals what's been done in shows like The Wire, which we mentioned, Mad Men, The Wonderful Breaking Bad. That's terrific narrative art. And it's actually a really good time for young writers to look at, for $50, buy the DVD box set, and it's a masterclass in storytelling.
You have a story in here that chronicles a middle-aged dad's emotional meltdown. It's punctuated by references to all of the finer things that he's collected. Brand name chocolates, American TV, Spanish pottery, all the trappings of success that have come with, well, that came with that Irish resurgence that has kind of died down.
Yeah, that story called Wifey Redux is kind of a direct satirical response, I suppose, to the Celtic Tiger boom years and the kind of new vulgarity that seeped out of the recesses of Irish life. It has since crashed spectacularly, as we know. So,
has that reality set in yet?
Yeah, it hasn't quite emerged in our fiction yet, in our writing. It's probably too soon. You know the way these things need so long to kind of percolate and season in a writer's mind. But I think we'll get very interesting work out of it in the coming years.
Your novel, City of Bohane, takes place in a future without digital technology. Is that something you're rooting for?
Maybe at some subconscious level, I think that's probably the case.
Yeah. So you don't spend much time on the internet?
I try not to. The internet is the devil for writers. It really is, you know, because we're always looking for reasons to procrastinate, and it's such an easy one.
In another story, you have a character who calls Van Morrison an Oompa Loompa.
Okay.
Is that based on his looks or the kinds of songs he writes, or is this also about rejecting some of the Irish heroes of a previous generation?
Well, I today hereby dutifully apologize to Van for that reference to Oompa Loompa-ness. I love his music, and I would never reject Van in any way.
Well, but Astral Weeks does not sound like anything that we're hearing today from rock musicians.
Yeah, and I think, again, we talked about that blandness that has seeped into contemporary life, and I think we're hearing it as well as seeing it all the time.
You were a journalist. Do you think that your style, which has a certain amount of bluntness to it, but also has these some very lyrical moments, is that something that came out of the journalism or fighting against what you had to do as a journalist?
I think actually that one thing journalism as a background does give you as a writer is it takes a lot of the preciousness out of it. You know you can always write. You don't have to lie around waiting for the muse to whisper in your ear. You know you can always get words down on the page. So that's what it gives you usefully, I think.
Well, you've said that you spent your 20s and 30s wanting to write full time. So was journalism just a way to pay the bills?
It was paying the rent. It was keeping a roof over my head. But I knew that I wasn't using a part of my brain that I needed to be using, which was that subconscious place where stories come from.
How were you able to wind up writing full time?
I got poor for a while, and I just gave it all, you know. And you have to make sacrifices if you're going to get through. It's a tough game, and it's a tough life.
One of the stories here is about a poet with writer's block who buys a hotel and a bar in the hopes that he'll be inspired by his patrons. Beyond the bar part, which I want to get to in a moment, is that something that you've been concerned with, writer's block? Because as you said, as a journalist, you never have to worry about where the story's coming from.
I've never had the words seize up on me or dry up in that way. I think sometimes you find that you're writing badly and the stuff isn't very good. And for me, maybe that's a version of block.
Well, in that story, you write that writer's block is a hopeless lust. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a kind of a want for the material that you know is inside you, but it's not quite coming sometimes, and there's a frustration. And I mean, when you say as a writer that you're going into work in the morning, what you mean is you're about to crawl into your nerves. That's where it comes out of. And it's a murky, strange place to spend your working days, and it's not always easy, you know?
My guest is Kevin Barry, whose latest book is a collection of short stories called Dark Lies the Island. We're talking about Ireland. You started off publishing short stories, and then you wrote the novel. And the novel got a lot more attention than the short stories. Is that just because short stories don't get as much attention?
It's the way, I mean, when you arrive into a publisher's office with a book of stories, it's like you've dragged a corpse into the room. You know, they want the novel. It's kind of changing in a funny way because we have so much less time now. I think the short story has come into the limelight just a little bit.
Well, is it hopeful for someone like you that Alice Munro just won the Nobel Prize for Literature?
That's fantastic news this morning.
She's pretty much only written short stories.
Yeah, and what I love about Alice Munro, tremendous writer, but I love the fact that she has stuck with the story as a form all the way through her long career. And I'm sure she's had so much pressure over the years to write novels, but no, she's stuck with that form. And she's got the reward, which is usually deserved today.
And many of the best short story writers didn't write the best novels. Flannery O'Connor, she returned to short stories after.
Some writers, I think, are congenitally short story writers, and that's where their muse comes and strikes.
Well, what about you? In an interview, you said that your stories come to you in hallucinogenic visions.
Yeah, I'm
each one of these stories come from some kind of an acid trip.
Yeah, I'm occasionally given to hyperbole. I would say most often the stories come from voices, and they come from talk and overheard lines that just stick in my head for days on end. And I know the only way to get them out is to write them out.
These stories are about everyday tragedies in these characters' lives, but they're often darkly funny. And you also have your characters try to be funny.
Yeah. I mean, I think comedy is the most human mode. We get through life by laughing through the pain and misery and cruelty and horrors of it. And for me, the comic mode for me is the way I operate. And most of my favorite writers, we mentioned people like Roth and Bellow, at some level are comic writers also.
You've said that keeping a writer's notebook is like a fetish. Do you go back to the notebooks for inspiration, or are they just there to write your thoughts of the moment?
I do go back to the notebooks all the time, and it's amazing how little you get out of them. But I think it makes you feel like a pro. It makes you feel like you're paying attention and you're keeping an eye on things and an ear on things.
Although some writers have told me that they've looked back at old diaries or notebooks and realized that they had a really wonderful thought about 10 years ago, and maybe that would make for a good short story. They couldn't handle it at the time.
That's interesting. What I find often is that it's very hard to store the stuff up. You have to catch it on the fly. If I make a note and say, great story, asterisk, alongside it, you can't go back 6 months later and write it. You have to do it when the heat is there.
Are you going to be writing more short stories? I'm assuming that you've written them all along. Or is there another novel in the works?
There's a novel on the desk at the moment, but I do occasionally find myself sneaking off to have a fling with a short story, you know?
You've also talked about a writer's ego. Could you write seriously without having a healthy ego?
No, writers are composed 99% of pure, unadulterated ego.
It didn't hurt when you won some awards. they probably swelled your head a bit.
I've been on a roll, Leonard. I've got some great prizes, and it's been a fantastic couple of years. Yeah.
The European Union Prize for Literature, the Authors Club Best First Novel Award. Your novel, City of Bohain, was shortlisted for the Costa First Novel Award and the Frank O'Connor International Short Story Award. Yeah. And now this, your third collection of short stories?
Yeah, it's my second collection of stories, third book. So, I've been lucky. And I mean, I try not to forget that it's a privilege to be able to stay indoors in my house in County Sligo and make up my mad little worlds, you know, and not have to go outside. And I always try to remember that's a privileged thing to be able to do.
Kevin Barry's collection, his latest collection, is called Dark Lies the Island, and it is published by Grey Wolf. Thank you so much for being with
us. Thanks, Leonard. Pleasure.
Kevin Barry will be in conversation with Craig Finn, lead singer of The Hold Steady, tonight at 7:30 at the Greenlight Bookstore. That's at 686 Fulton Street in Brooklyn. Up next, Adam Skolnick explains how Hawaii has become the latest battleground for the debate over genetically modified crops and whether they're saving local crops or destroying them. And then later on, we'll find out which sites that have made the World Monument Fund's latest watch list are endangered cultural heritage sites. And here's a reminder that we're reading Peter Carey's Oscar and Lucinda this month for the Leonard LoPage Show Book Club. It's set in the 19th century in Australia, and this Booker Prize-winning novel follows Oscar and Lucinda as they discover that they share a guilty passion for gambling. It's a story of love and commerce, religion and colonialism that culminates in a crazy expedition to transport a glass church across the outback. Get your copy today and share your thoughts on the novel on our show page anytime. You may have already read it, so you probably have lots of thoughts about it. Our show page is at wnyc.org. And you're listening to WNYC and wnyc.org.